Anyway, it's 9 o'clock here on a Thursday night. It is time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you could possibly use. And let's start off with an announcement. This announcement is for folks who, I believe, live in the Portland, Oregon area. And even though it was hotter than blazes up there today, this coming Saturday, they're going to have a benefit for the Elliott Free State 27. These are 27 people who got arrested defending the forest. And that is a state forest up in Oregon, arrested after the Earth First Round River Rendezvous. They went out and erected a blockade, held off the feds for 5 days. And anyway, or was it 4 days? Anyway, there is a benefit this Saturday in Portland at the Red and Black Cafe. That's at the corner of Southeast 12th and Oak. It starts at 7 p.m. Let's see if I can read this stuff. Rising Phoenix Society Old Timey Party Brown Creek. Here Comes Trouble. Ukulele Country Funk. And there'll be a slideshow, there'll be updates, and more. $3 to $10 sliding scale fee requested at the door, but no one will be turned away for lack of funds. That's this Saturday, August 1st, at the Red and Black Cafe, Southeast 12th and Oak Street in Portland, Oregon, at 7 p.m. Support the Elliott Free State 27. Surfrider Santa Cruz is going to be having their beach cleanup this Saturday at Three Mile Beach. Saturday, August 1st, Surfrider Santa Cruz will have its monthly beach cleanup at Three Mile Beach from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Three Mile Beach is about, you guessed it, 3 miles up the coast from Swift Street, for those of you who don't know the coast like we do. So experience tells us this beach always needs a cleanup. No kidding, the path in from the Coast Highway and the beach and bluff seem to collect all kinds of human-generated trash and other junk. Look for our chapter banners along the roadway at the entrance gate and say hola to Vice Chair Dustin McDonald, who's giving up time in the water to lead this one for us. Anyway, this Saturday, right here in Santa Cruz, 3 Mile Beach, 11 a.m. for a cleanup. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. The Buffalo Field Campaign spent last week at the Summer Outdoor Retailers Conference in Salt Lake City, Utah. This was the third outdoor retailers conference we've attended, and thanks to the generosity of Patagonia, Clean Canteen, and Osprey Backpacks, by far the most successful to date. Patagonia provided us with passes for the event and a table at their booth where we shared the bison's plight with hundreds of conference attendees, and collected nearly 1,000 postcards asking President Obama to protect wild bison on their year-round habitat. Earned nearly $4,000 through a special fundraiser made possible by the generosity of Clean Canteen, and hosted a spectacular event where we raffled high-quality gear from Osprey, Patagonia, and Clean Canteen off to the public. We are deeply grateful for the generosity of these three companies and their commitment to protecting the natural world. Clean Canteen donated hundreds of limited edition Let Buffalo Roam stainless steel water bottles for the event, and they, Osprey and Patagonia, made the bottles available at their booths in exchange for donations to the Buffalo Field Campaign for the duration of the event. Guess what? The Buffalo Field Campaign is selling the remainder of these eco-friendly water bottles on our website. For more information and to get one of the limited edition bottles while they last, please visit our website. And we are deeply grateful for those of you who have sent donations in response to our announcement of the Earth Friends Challenge grant. But we have a long way to go if we are to meet the Earth Friends Challenge to raise $75,000 by year's end. With the number and amount of donations shown in recent months and with foundation grants on a sharp decline, the Earth Friends Challenge couldn't come at a better time. Many nonprofits have been forced to close their doors and countless others have had to scale back on their programs. The Buffalo Field Campaign, accustomed to accomplishing a great deal on a shoestring budget and poised to achieve many of our goals for the bison, cannot afford to scale back right now. So please donate today and help the Buffalo Field Campaign meet their challenge offered by the Earth Friends Wildlife Foundation. Also coming up for the Buffalo Field Campaign, the Woodcut Weekend, September 14th through the 20th. Join Buffalo Field Campaign in beautiful West Yellowstone the week of September 14th through the 20th and help gather, stack, and cut the wood that will keep volunteers warm and alive this coming winter field season. Room and board provided. Contact Mike at meese@wildrockies.org. That's meese@wildrockies.org if you plan on attending that event. The Buffalo Field Campaign volunteer cabin needs two on-demand hot water heaters. The Buffalo Field Campaign main cabin, which houses our volunteers, could use two on-demand hot water heaters in order to save energy and space. These energy-efficient water heaters could shave 25% off our gas bill each month. They will also allow us room to make another bathroom so our volunteers won't have to form a waiting line to use the current one. If you can help, please make a secure online donation and specify it is for the water heaters or send a check or money order to BFC Maintenance, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. If you have questions or would like more detail, please contact Buffalo Field Campaign Maintenance Coordinator Chip. His number 406-646-0070 or email at maintenance@buffalofieldcampaign.org. Thank you. Once again, that address, Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. The number again, 406-646-0070, or visit the webpage at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And a satellite shows that Arctic sea ice now more thin than thick. Arctic sea ice has thinned between the winters of 2004 and 2008, with thin seasonal ice replacing thicker, older ice as the dominant type for the first time on record, according to the first basin-wide estimate of the thickness and volume of the Arctic Ocean's ice cover. The total area covered by the thicker, older, multi-year ice that has survived one or more summers shrank by 42% over the four-year period based on data from a NASA Earth-orbiting spacecraft. The study provides further evidence for the rapid, ongoing transformation of the Arctic's ice cover. Scientists from NASA and the University of Washington in Seattle conducted the most comprehensive survey to date using observations from NASA's Ice Cloud and Land Elevation Satellite, known as ICESat. In the past, scientists had relied only on measurements of the area to determine how much of the Arctic Ocean is covered in ice, but ICESat makes it possible to monitor ice thickness and volume changes over the entire Arctic Ocean for the first time. The results gave scientists a better understanding of the regional distribution of ice and provide better insight into what is happening in the Arctic Ocean. Ice volume allows us to calculate annual ice production and gives us an inventory of the freshwater and total ice mass stored in Arctic sea ice, said a researcher. Even in years when the overall extent of sea ice remains stable or grows slightly, the thickness and volume of the ice cover is continuing to decline, making the ice more vulnerable to continued shrinkage. ICESat measures the distances to the top of the ice cover and to the sea surface. The difference between the two measurements gives the total freeboard, that is, the amount of ice above the waterline relative to the local sea level. Our data will help scientists better understand how fast the volume of Arctic ice is decreasing and how soon we might see a nearly ice-free Arctic in the summer. The Arctic ice cap grows each winter as the sun sets for several months and intense cold ensues in the summer. Wind and ice currents cause some of the ice naturally to flow out of the Arctic while much of it melts in place. But not all of the Arctic ice melts each summer. The thicker, older ice is more likely to survive. Seasonal sea ice usually reaches about 6 feet in thickness, while multi-year sea ice averages 9 or more. Using ICESat measurements, scientists found that overall Arctic ice thinned about 7 inches a year, for a total of 2.2 feet less over the four winters studied. In recent years, the amount of ice replaced in the winter has not been sufficient to offset summer ice losses. The result is more open water in summer, which then absorbs more heat, warming the ocean and further melting the ice. Between 2004 and 2008, multi-year ice shrank some 595,000 square miles, nearly the size of Alaska. During the study period, the relative contributions of the two ice types to the total volume of the Arctic's ice cover were reversed. In 2003, 62% of the Arctic's total ice volume was stored in multi-year ice, with 38% stored in first-year seasonal ice. By 2008, 68% of the total ice volume was first-year ice, with only 32% being multi-year. One of the main things that has been missing from information about what is happening with sea ice is comprehensive data about ice thickness, said Jay Zawali, study co-author and ISAT project scientist at NASA's Goddard Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. U.S. Navy submarines provide a long-term high-resolution record of ice thickness over only parts of the Arctic. The submarine data agree with the ISAT measurements, giving us great confidence in satellites as a way of monitoring thickness across the whole Arctic basin. The research team attributes the changes in the overall thickness and volume of Arctic Ocean sea ice to recent warming and anomalies in patterns of sea ice circulation. One researcher said the near-zero replenishment of the multi-year ice cover, combined with unusual exports of ice out of the Arctic over the summers of 2005 and 2007, have both played significant roles in the loss of Arctic sea ice volume over the ICESat record. And here's the forest update for July 2009. The forest update is prepared by Jody Frediani of the Sierra Club Forestry Task Force. First off the bat is AB 1066, sponsored by Assemblymember Mendoza from Los Angeles. Started as a bill to increase all timber harvest plans from 3-year permits with 2 1-year extensions possible to 10-year permits with 2 1-year extensions. Mendoza's interest seemed to stem from family connections of his wife to the timber industry. On July 6th, the bill passed out of the Senate Natural Resources Committee on a vote to 7-2. Joe Sumidian abstained, thanks to lobbying efforts on the part of Sierra Club and a host of other environmental organizations. The bill has gone through a number of iterations, and the Senate Natural Resources Committee recommended a version that would return the initial TH permit to a 3-year time frame. Good for only 2010 and 2011 only, THPs could be extended twice for 2 more years if they meet the typically lax and or unenforceable conditions. If no newly discovered listed species are found, but there are no provisions to look for them, and two, if significant physical changes to the harvest area or adjacent areas have not occurred since the THP's cumulative impacts were originally assessed. Anyone want to take bets on what might constitute such a significant physical change? Well, existing approved THPs would be able to extend for 4 1-year extensions rather than the current 2. No additional conditions would be imposed on these already approved timber harvest plans. Environmental lobbyists in Sacramento have been taking the opportunity provided by review of this bill to educate legislatures on the problems with clear-cutting and inadequate protections for threatened and impaired watersheds, those that provide habitat for coho, steelhead, and chinook. Sierra Club continues to oppose the bill. And the threatened or impaired watershed proposed rules have been weakened. On July 8th, the Board of Forestry voted to notice the amended threatened or impaired watershed rule plead for a 45-day public review period. The latest version of the proposal, a joint Department of Fish and Game and Cal Fire plead with an options proposed by board members, is not yet posted on the board's website, but you should probably go check. At this point, it would be at www.bof.fire.gov.ca.gov. That's bof.fire.ca.gov/regulations/proposed_rule_packages. A number of options were added by Tom Waltz, industry board member who works for Sierra Pacific Industries. They weakened the package that was jointly prepared by Cal Fire and Department of Fish and Game. The joint agency plead already makes some things worse for the southern sub-district, which includes San Mateo, Santa Clara, San Benito, and Santa Cruz counties. While these proposed rules would require a 30-foot no-harvest buffer adjacent to Class 1 streams, they decrease the watercourse lake and protection zone from 150 feet to 100 feet, where only uneven management is allowed. That's us, all of the southern sub-district. The unintended consequence of this is that roads will be allowed to be constructed as close as 100 feet from water from fish-bearing streams. Currently, this is only allowed as a justified in-lieu practice. The other special rules for the southern sub-district, thanks to last-minute lobbying by Big Creek Lumber, would delete the proposed 34 no harvest buffer adjacent to Class 2 streams, as well as requirements for 85% canopy retention for the next 85 feet, with 65% canopy retention for the next 50 feet. In their place would be a complicated set of rules requiring 85% canopy retention over the stream channel only. I guess registered professional foresters will need to step out in the middle of each stream to get their measurements. Channel zone trees would not be allowed to be cut, but one-third of all trees which have roots permeating the bank or providing channel grade control will be available for harvest. And the rest of the Wilpez, redwoods 12 inches or greater, will need to be no more than 25 feet from each other. No more than one-third of the conifers 18 inches in diameter at breast height or larger may be harvested. Will this protect our endangered coho? No one knows for sure, as these changes were not vetted through the scientific literature review or the technical advisory committee. Studies done by the North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board indicate that this rule will not be sufficient. They were only proposed at the 11th hour after an extensive two-year rule development process. The North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board found that 85% canopy was needed adjacent to Class 1 and Class 2 streams to keep the stream temperatures from rising as much as a degree to a degree and a half. While no streams have been listed yet for temperature in Santa Cruz County, I've had the opportunity to review data showing temperatures significantly warmer than those needed by coho for optimal growth and survival in multiple area streams. Please stay tuned for the next Board of Forestry hearing on these rules and plan to attend, or at minimum plan to submit written comments. And the Regional Water Quality Control Board guts the timber program. In a great giveaway to the timber industry on Friday, July 10th, the Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board voted to adopt staff recommendations as submitted on proposed modifications to the board's timber waiver program. Half a dozen dedicated forest and watershed advocates, including several informed Sierra Club members, that's me, spoke passionately at the hearing in Watsonville about the absurdity of allowing the dischargers to enroll themselves under the timber waiver without review of their applications by staff. Additionally, concern was expressed about essentially eliminating most of the monitoring requirements, including temperature, turbidity, and photo point monitoring. Staff will now plan on reviewing only 3 to 4 timber harvest plans per year as part of CAL FIRE's review team. Currently, there are 10 THPs under review in Santa Cruz County. 9 are in watersheds that are listed under the Federal Clean Water Act as impaired for sediment and siltation. The 10th timber harvest plan is in a watershed with a TMDL, that's a total maximum daily load, that seeks to reduce sediment by 90%. Staff claimed insufficient funding and staff time to properly conduct the programs, justifying the reduced oversight on the largely unsubstantiated grounds that logging creates minimal risk. Board member Monica Hunter did urge staff to look into charging fees for waivers. Staff had originally stated that only the State Water Board could impose fees until we quoted chapter and verse to staff, at which point they acknowledged their error. And an end run attempt to delist the San Vicente Creek has been foiled. The good news is that San Vicente Creek remains 303D listed. In a stealthy move, Redwood Empire Sawmills RPF Michael Duffy submitted an 11th hour request. Actually, it was after the 11th hour. It was at 12:02. With the Water Board to remove Davenport San Vicente Creek from the impaired list. The San Vicente Creek was added to the 303D list for sediment impairment in 2006 after Sierra Club members submitted data and testified showing excessive sediment levels during winter months, most likely caused by upstream logging activities. Davenport residents who get their drinking water from the creek have been forced to boil water during the winter when rain runoffs carry sediment from logging roads and creates turbid conditions too extreme for the county's treatment system. Sediment may also get deposited over gravels used by salmon for spawning. In fact, a Department of Fish and Game report showed heavy embeddedness of such gravels in San Vicente Creek. The period for submission of new 303D listing and delisting requests to the Water Board for this round closed in February of 2007. Yet Redwood Empire submitted their request just 10 days before the July 10th hearing in Watsonville. Apparently, staff felt obliged to process the request and recommended delisting based on 1,400 data points, which included many months of no rainfall, giving a false impression that all is well in the watershed. Several members of the public, including Sierra Clubbers, objected to the total breach of public process. We were only informed of the recommendation at the morning of the hearing. No data was available for our review, and the staff report was also unavailable. In addition, the Water Board website was down, so we had no access to any information other than what we were told by staff. Fortunately, three of the five board members present voted against the delisting recommendation, recognizing that the public 45-day period for review had been violated. Yes, that means that the other two board members saw no problem with the total lack of public process. I wonder why. And the State Water Board suggests a timber waiver end run of its own. Recently, the North Coast Water Board took several major steps towards increased protection for beneficial uses in their revised timber waiver. They went above and beyond the forest practice rules, requiring 85% canopy retention along Class 2 streams in threatened or impaired watersheds. They also now require an erosion control plan and a sediment reduction plan. Winter operations are not allowed from November 15th through April 1st, and staff must fully participate in the THP review, and there is a minimum fee of $250 per application. However, the timber industry and CAL FIRE were apparently incensed at the audacity of the North Coast Water Board to take matters to protect streams and fish from logging into their own hands. Well, that's what the legislature told them to do. As a result, the State Water Board chair has now come out with a statement that management of the timber waiver program should be handled by the state board and not the regional boards. He is proposing that the State Water Board write statewide conditional waivers and water discharge requirements to be administered by the State Water Board and or the Department of Forestry, which is now under State Water Board authority. The chair, appointed by the governor in March of 2009, is the immediate past chairman of the California Rice Industry Association. Wow, industry is on a roll. Excuse me. First with AB 1066, then efforts to weaken the threatened or impaired watershed rules. Now the Central Coast Waiver Program is a self-regulating process, and the North Coast Program, as well as all regional water board timber waivers and WDRs, are in jeopardy. Must be nice to have some influence in Sacramento. And in our final story, Trout Gulch THP angers neighbors. Residents of Westwood Lane and Larson Road in Aptos continue to seek protection of their private roads, which are slated to be used for hauling logs from Trout Gulch THP, that's 10921 SCR of Hen Trong. Negotiations grew contentious over road use for the last timber harvest plan on the same parcel, with both sides ultimately suing each other. The neighbors, however, were successful in getting Trong to install a retaining wall to keep one of their roads from failing. Trong's suits of the neighbors were ultimately thrown out of court as slap suits, and he was required to pay their attorney's fees. Imagine that. The forest practice rules are deficient when it comes to protecting private roads used for hauling lumber. A special rule for Santa Cruz County would allow posting of a bond up to $5,000 per mile for road damage caused by logging activities. Of course, this figure was set in the mid-90s and is now too low to cover any kind of extensive damage in today's dollars. And that's it for the forestry update for July. We thank Jody Frediani, a forestry consultant for the Santa Cruz Group of the Ventana Chapter of the Sierra Club, for preparing this monthly report, and hopefully we can make sure that she keeps doing that. Moving on to some environmental news. A suit targets a 6,000-mile habitat-wrecking energy corridor. In defiance of dirty energy and in defense of public lands and species, the Center for Biological Diversity and their allies have sued over a Bush-era plan designating energy corridors that would promote fossil fuels and slice through special places across the West. Instead of taking advantage of the region's vast potential for wind, solar, and geothermal energy, according to state, local, and Obama administration policies, the plan sets aside about 6,000 miles and 3.2 million acres of federal land in 11 western states as right-of-ways for pipelines, transmission lines, and related infrastructure to transfer energy from coal-fired power plants and other dirty power sources. In designating the corridors, the Bush administration didn't consider effects on species and lands. It also failed to consult with local and state governments, ignored congressional testimony, and flouted thousands of written comments supporting environmentally sensitive corridors. The currently designated corridors would affect Utah's Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument and Arches National Park, as well as New Mexico's Cevallita National Wildlife Refuge. The west-wide corridors perpetuate the coal infrastructure that must become obsolete very soon if we're to avoid the worst effects of climate change, said Center Public Energy Lands Director Amy Atwood. We must develop a west-wide energy corridor that facilitates a rapid transition to a green energy economy while doing everything we can to protect the West's wildlife and ecosystems. And a rare salamander has been discovered just in time to be saved. What's lungless, projectile-tongued, and unique all over? The patch-nosed salamander, or Urspelerpes brucei, an exceptional new salamander species that was just discovered along a remote Appalachian stream, a species so distinct it was declared a new genus. The species breathes through its moist, porous skin and catches small insects with its tongue like many other lungless compadres, but instead of the usual four toes on each foot, this salamander has five. Males and females are different in both number of spinal vertebrae and color, the females lacking the male's flashy stripes, plus the patch-nosed salamander measures a minuscule 25 to 26 millimeters, that's about an inch, the smallest salamander in the United States. It can wrap its little body around a dime. Tragically, while the species is getting its first taste of fame, it may already be on the verge of extinction like numerous southeast wetland creatures. It desperately needs protection. The Center for Biological Diversity is investigating the status of the patch-nosed salamander and will include it in an upcoming petition to put imperiled southeast wetland species on the endangered species list. And in our final story tonight, spotlight on the Death Valley proposed wilderness additions. On the extreme southern boundary of Death Valley National Park, the narrow strip of land between the park and Fort Irwin, known as the Bowling Alley, is a remote area featuring rugged mountains and deep canyons separated by open valleys, bajadas, and pristine dry lake beds. The geological history of the area dates back nearly 2 billion, with a B, years, and the earliest human inhabitants appeared about 1,000 years ago. The land is a natural, common-sense extension of Death Valley National Park. For the patient visitor, this desert reveals her charm slowly. The one permanent spring, Quail Spring, exists in an elevation of 4,000 feet, creating a rich riparian area while attracting a wide variety of birds. Owl Hole Spring provides intermittent water for an array of animals and a green oasis for visitors. Sparse rainfall may drain into Owl Lake or Lost Lake, dry lakes that see water just a few days a year, or not at all. These ephemeral lakes offer a changing landscape based on the season and the year's rainfall. The diverse topography and vegetation support a variety of wildlife, including two protected species, the desert tortoise and the desert bighorn sheep. This area's vast, rugged terrain offers outstanding opportunities for solitude and primitive recreation, including backpacking and hiking. Its pristine and isolated nature offers unique opportunities for geological, archaeological, and ecological research. And that's all the time we have for news this week. We want to thank the Center for Biological Diversity for providing that biological diversity update. The Earth First update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you'd like to hear a podcast of this or previous Earth First updates, you can visit the following webpage. That's h2opodcast.com. That's h2opodcast.com. When you get there, click on Earth and then click on Earth First Radio, and you will find a listing of Earth First updates there for your downloading or listening pleasure. And we thank the folks at H2O Podcast for recording and providing those shows for our listeners. Tune in next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock for another Earth First update right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org.